Welcome to the CREXI podcast, an insider's look at all things commercial real estate. Each episode, the CREXI team dives into a broad range of topics to investigate trends, educate listeners, and understand the latest industry news. As the nation's fastest growing online CRE platform, we're excited to provide a window into the inner workings of commercial real estate for this generation and the next. Welcome and thank you all for joining this episode of the CREXI podcast, an insider's look at all things commercial real estate. I'm your host, Ashley Kopovich, Regional Director at CREXI, and we are thrilled to sit down with our guest today, Alex Woodleaf of B6 Real Estate Advisors. Before we dive in, a little bit about our guest. Alex Woodleaf is a Director of Investment Sales with B6, specializing in Manhattan's Midtown South market. Alex has expertise in value-add loft office, commercial development, and ground lease transactions. He has been involved in the underwriting, sale, and capital raising of over $4 billion of New York City commercial real estate. Alex joined B6 from Kauffman Investments, the institutional acquisition arm of the Kauffman Organization, one of New York's oldest and largest private owners of office buildings. At Kauffman, he was responsible for sourcing new investment opportunities, managing landlord partnerships, and business development initiatives. Before Kauffman, Alex was an associate in the capital markets group of Cushman & Wakefield, focusing on the middle market investment sales transactions in Manhattan. Earlier, he raised capital for real estate credit and equity strategies for REIT sponsor American Realty Capital. Previously, he served as asset manager for Saget National Housing, a boutique owner, operator, and lender specializing in nationwide student housing assets. Alex graduated from Northeast University with a BS in political science. He is a licensed real estate salesperson in New York and has held his FINRA Series 7 and 63 licenses. Alex, welcome to the podcast.
So happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Of course. So happy to sit down with you. Now, I know we just dived into a lot of your background for our listeners, but we would love to hear it from your perspective. So give us a little bit of an overview. Where are you from and how did you first get your start in commercial real estate?
Sure. So I actually grew up in Westchester County, just 30 miles north of here. Went to school in Boston. And my first foray into real estate, I was actually a part of a fraternity in college. And as a junior, I was recruited to essentially run their real estate platform. The fraternity is the largest in the country by undergraduate membership. They've got, you know, student housing assets or fraternity houses on campuses all across the country. And I was recruited to work for them upon graduation. So I graduated, moved to Richmond, Virginia, spent a summer there training, and then essentially became the asset manager for our fraternity's real estate portfolio. At the time, we owned 12 or 15, you know, assets on university campuses, and we had about 50 loans to different groups that owned and operated these fraternity houses. I was on 80 flights a year. I've been on over 100 college campuses in the country. It was a very cool experience as a young, you know, recent grad, sort of getting my mini real estate MBA in a very niche market, right, in sort of the Greek fraternity housing world. But, you know, we reported to a board of directors, all, you know, very accomplished seasoned professionals in their own field. So it gave me sort of a great entry point into the real estate world.
That's awesome. What a fun experience. Beer pong, Beirut, Flip Cup.
Yeah, unfortunately, at that point, you know, we kind of had to have the adult hats on because I'll tell you, though, it's really tough. The toughest part about student housing is that for the most part, your tenants are people that care about Thursday, Friday, Saturday night. They're 18 to 22 year olds. They don't really know that the house or the apartment building has a mortgage on it, that someone's got to be making these payments.
Yep.
You know, their parents are guaranteeing these leases. And so we're the ones that say, well, no, you probably can't, you know, punch holes in the wall or do this. And so, you know, it was, again, it was a really cool experience. Got to meet, you know, really fascinating people. And it just sort of, it built a great foundation for me to understand everything from, you know, acquisition, disposition, property management, asset management, financing. So it was, again, it was a great little sort of experience very, very early on in my career.
Absolutely. And I'm sure you learned a ton of lessons early on that translate into what you know now. I mean, that comes with a whole host of challenges, you know, with that kind of tenant base. Yeah. We'll get into more of the lessons, you know, a little bit later. But what then drew you from that experience to then the office sector?
Sure. So I actually, before I got into the office sector, I was doing that job from Richmond, Virginia, which is where our headquarters was, but again, sure. I was on the road a lot. I moved up to New York and I started working for a company called American Realty Capital, which was a private REIT sponsor. And, you know, we were raising retail equity to go out and buy institutional real estate. And we were buying everything from retail assets to hospitals, healthcare, hotels, office buildings. So we pretty much had a fund vehicle for each different asset type. And so what was really cool about that opportunity is, one, it sort of gave me a little bit of the institutional acumen going from managing fraternity houses to raising, you know, billions of dollars for an institutional asset manager. But it also really sort of furthered my education or perspective on all the different asset types across the country. And not even country, we were actually doing global investments also. So I sort of described that role, you know, I sort of had to be an inch deep, but a mile wide. So sure. I had to be able to talk about, again, all these different asset types, all these different geographies. So it just sort of furthered help build that foundation for me. And so that was sort of my entry point into the institutional world. Mm-hmm. And then from there, that's when I made the move over to Cushman Wakefield. So my first time as a broker was after sort of that stint at American Realty Capital.
Okay.
And then the move to Cushman was, you know, I was actually part of like the legacy Massey Knackel group. Mm-hmm. So we focused in the middle market. We were territory based. I worked with, you know, my senior partner covered Midtown East. Mm-hmm. And Midtown East, you know, is very, you know, there's all different asset types there. There's, you know, the 1-4 family walk ups over, you know, between First and York. And then you have the billion-dollar towers on Park Avenue. We weren't selling the billion-dollar towers, but, you know, it was great because we did a lot of multifamily deals, a lot of development deals. Actually, not a ton of office there either. It wasn't until I moved over to the Kauffman organization where I really sort of honed in on the office sector.
Okay. Okay. Awesome. Well, it seems like you have a ton of experience in a lot of different asset classes, a lot of different institutions. So talk to us. Here's the million-dollar question that everyone wants to know. What are some lessons that you learned that are so pivotal in your career that you still take to this day? So early on, middle, later, give us all the goods.
Sure. So, you know, lessons learned, I find that every day I'm learning something a little bit. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that comes with making mistakes. It also comes with surrounding yourself with people that are, you know, better than you or more experienced than you or smarter than you.
Yep.
You know, I'm a firm believer in sort of that you're kind of the average of the, you know, the top 5 or 10 people that you spend the most, you know, most of your time with.
Yep.
So I've always tried to, you know, attach myself or spend a lot of time with folks that are, you know, doing what I do, but are more senior or have done it for a lot longer than me. The way that I approach brokerage now, I like to say I sort of wear the principal hat because I've been on the other side of the table. So I've been the buyer in that situation. I've been the, you know, the guy that's underwritten the deal in the models, trying to figure out, you know, okay, does this deal work for, you know, why does it work? Why doesn't it work? And so sort of the lessons that I've learned along the way about, again, just sort of having a, you know, a sharp pencil when it comes to underwriting, but also sort of understanding the mechanics behind how these deals worked has, I think, afforded me a certain opportunity on the brokerage side because I can sort of bring that, again, sort of principal side to the, you know, the intermediation business or the, you know, the transactional side.
I love that you have both sides of the coin and both different perspectives, which you bring to your everyday work. I love hearing that. One thing that you mentioned is, you know, which I love is you are kind of the top 5 people you surround yourself with, or you kind of become that, right? And you don't want to be, you know, I always say, if you're the smartest person in the room, find another room, right?
Yes.
You know, you got to continuously do that for yourself. For some of our listeners, whether they're early on in their career or they've been in the business a while, how do they go about taking those steps and continuously growing that network? Obviously, you have a huge one in a lot of different areas. How do you personally do that? What advice would you give to them?
Well, I think, you know, something that was a tenet of the original sort of Massey Knackel infrastructure, and, you know, we carry with us at B6 today, is our territory, right? Our physical geographic territory that we spend a lot of our time in, but we also have the second territory, and we call the second territory, you know, those are they're your friends, they're your family, they're the attorneys, they're the financial advisors, they're the architects, they're the engineers, they're the other folks that help you sort of expand that network. And networking in real estate, I think, is paramount. You know, we know that. But I think really, you know, making a dedicated effort to build that network and sort of build, I try to sort of build little spheres within my over, I call it my universe. So okay. I have a, and this is, I took this from my, actually my boss at American Realty Capital, but he sort of had, he called like his, whatever, his database, or he called it the universe. And so I sort of borrowed that term from him. But, you know, so in my universe, I have my, you know, sphere from Northeastern, right? So everybody that went to Northeastern, I have my sphere that are, you know, in the fraternity I was in. I have my sphere that, you know, maybe they grew up in my hometown or they grew up in Westchester, or, you know, I have the family sphere. So I think sort of trying to develop these sort of smaller networks within the bigger one, you know, one, it makes networking a little bit easier because there's that sort of soft intro, that warm intro. It's not just a cold, hey, you know, I'm in real estate, you're in real estate, let's get a coffee.
Right.
Instead, it's, hey, I saw you went to Northeastern, or I saw, you know, your son or daughter went to Northeastern. Like, there's any way you can build sort of a small connection.
Sure.
But it just helps you farm because it's a constant system, right? You're always staying on top of these folks.
Yep.
And I think that really helps sort of on the networking side.
I love that. And just like doing a little bit of research, making it a little bit more personalized, right? It's not just a cold call,
right?
But it's a little bit, hey, I did a little bit of homework on this, and then I might know this person who knows this person, and using that universe to your advantage. I love
for
that.
For sure, yeah. And I'm a huge advocate too of, and I tell, you know, whether it's young people or anybody, you know, you should connect with them, whether it's on LinkedIn or Instagram today, and try and leverage those connections anytime you're trying to meet somebody new. Because the cold, you know, whether you're applying for a job or trying to meet a principal or, you know, trying to get hired on a deal, if they can, you know, if you can get to that person, not just by your pitch or by your intro, but through somewhere else that person already knows and trusts, it puts you way over the edge. And it's much easier to sort of, again, either get that assignment or, you know, get that coffee or, you know, make that connection.
Absolutely. And the power of social media today is huge and it's just continuously growing.
I know.
So using that to your advantage, you know, is absolutely key, especially in such a relationship business like commercial real estate. So I love that. Now, one of the things too, Alex, you were talking about is mistakes, right? So give our listeners a little bit of maybe a favorite mistake that you've had happen throughout your career that maybe made you course correct or just was very instrumental in your growth.
Sure. So, you know, again, I think mistakes are critical, right? And, you know, I don't know the name of the book, but there's like the fail often, you know, some of that
fast,
terminology.
Fail forward.
Yeah, exactly. You know, for me, I would say, I think I've learned the most, I would say, thankfully, I make mistakes all the time, right?
Same.
But I would say, thankfully, there hasn't been one particular like, oh, you know, you really screwed this up. You sent the wrong document or you issued the wrong, you know.
Sure.
So there's not one specific, but the mistakes I find myself either making most often or learning the most from are, you know, whatever the difficult situation is, whether it's that call that you really should make first or that person that you should notify about something, or you know this tenant's going to be tricky and you say, you know, let's, you know, we'll deal with it at the end, we'll figure it out. Those are the ones that I find almost like without fail come back to sort of bite you in the end. And so I continue learning from that, like whatever the tough situation is, sort of, you know, address it, attack it at the outset because it's the uncomfortable part. But it's, you know, getting that done and sort of getting that, you know, either monkey off your back or sort of addressing the challenge in the beginning.
Yep.
I think it sort of paves the road for a smoother, whether it be transaction or, you know, meeting or, you know, whatever the situation is. But it's, again, it's those little mistakes like, yeah, you know what, I'll put that off. I'll talk to that person later. Or I'll, you know, I'll send that later. I'll do this. It's like, no, do that part first, because that's when I find myself at least getting behind the eight balls when sort of not addressing that up front.
For sure. And I think the monkey on the back situation is just so, you know, inevitable, right? It doesn't come off until you take
right.
it off.
Right? That's right. And by the way, it gets worse.
It gets worse.
The longer you wait, the bigger the monkey gets.
It gets heavier.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely. So doing that, and then just from a day-to-day perspective, I think doing the hardest tasks first, right, in the morning, or setting yourself up for success the night before, right? For me, it's even, oh, I don't want to pack my flights in the morning. I'll pack in the morning. Oh, that never goes well,
right?
So just do everything, you know, to set your future self up for success is sometimes what I like to think about it. So same page there. I love it. Alex, what fundamental tenets of your work ethic do you think, in your opinion, have contributed most to your success as an individual broker or as a team leader?
Sure. So I think, you know, I love sometimes the interview question where they'll say, you know, is it better to get the project right or is it better to do it on time? And it's, you know, there really is no right answer. But the idea is to get into the mind of the person that you're interviewing with, you know, like how do they approach problem solving and, you know, putting some type of product out the door. And personally, you know, one of my tenets is I want to get it right. Yeah. And I understand that, you know, particularly in our business, sometimes there are very hard and fast deadlines, whether it be a bid deadline or there's right. a closing date or something that, you know, you can't go beyond. But I'm a huge proponent of spending the extra time, whether, you know, it's staying up later or getting up earlier, you know, working mm-hmm. on that OM, working mm-hmm. on that counter offer, you know, whatever the situation mm-hmm. is. But I'm a big proponent of sort of getting it right the first time and spending the time necessary to do that. And I think also, too, just, you know, being disciplined. You know, our business is a, you know, there's a lot of repetition, yep. right? And we can get, as a broker, we can kind of get tied up in the day-to-day. You know, like, for example, today, and this is not a joke, I have not opened my laptop yet. And this is kind of a crazy day, but it's just gone from property tour yep. to coffee to meeting. Yep. And like you can spend weeks like that where you're, sure. you know, you're not getting to the office until 1-2 o'clock and you just get sort of behind on everything. Right. And so I think being disciplined and regimented about a schedule, setting time aside to either, whether it be making your cold calls or, yep. you know, making the calls on buildings or, you know, networking, mm-hmm. Or answering your emails, because again, you can, I mean, and again, I'm guilty of this too, where again, a day like today where I won't sit down for another 2 hours and, you know, basically the day is gone.
Yep.
So if you're not building that time into your schedule, I think it's tough. And then thirdly, I think is you have to do something for fun. I mean, I love this business and this is, you know, every day is fun for me,
yep.
but you know, I like to run. I like to go to the gym. I play golf, you know, mm-hmm. well, I try to, when I can, you know, both with the newborn at home and, you know, with work, it's getting harder and harder, but having some type of outlet to, you know, there's no such thing as disconnecting today. I think, right. We all have our cell phones in our pockets. It never stops. Yep. You know, you're always on call with yep. clients and that kind of thing. But I think having some type of outlet, whether it be a sport or your family or
sure.
something, I think too, just it keeps us sane, I think, a little bit.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Your thing with golf is about time. Mine is more ability. So I'm going to get to that, but
sure.
I absolutely agree. I think that setting some time apart for yourself is absolutely crucial. Some portion to disconnect, whether that is going on a run,
mm-hmm.
you know, putting a podcast on, doing something
right.
for yourself, being disciplined in that, because if you can discipline yourself to do it, then you can show up better for others. Second is just making sure that you're carving out those times for, you know, those revenue generating activities, right? I sometimes have to put it on my calendar or block off time
sure.
to make sure that I do things, right? You look at someone's calendar, you can pretty much tell who they are, right?
yeah.
By what they do in
yes.
practice day to day. So really like hearing some of that stuff. And then fourth, I want to kind of share with some of our listeners, you've probably done a lot of transactions throughout your career. So tell us, what was one of your favorite transactions and why, what made this particular one unique?
So I think, well, it's funny, some of my favorite transactions, some of my most memorable, were actually from the very early days
yeah.
as I was sort of getting started. I mentioned I worked for my fraternity,
yep.
and one of the first, call it, you know, cradle to grave or beginning to end real estate project I worked mm-hmm. on was we actually acquired a church in Ann Arbor, Michigan. It was decommissioned, of course, but then we converted that church into a fraternity house. And that building actually sat right on the corner where the business school and the law school was at the University of Michigan. And I'll never forget, you know, my partner and I, we, you know, again, we're young kids, you know, we're doing this real estate mm-hmm. thing for the fraternity. We rented the biggest U-Haul that you can drive without a commercial license. I think it was, you know, 50 feet long or 56 feet long, something ridiculous that we
yeah.
shouldn't have been driving. We flew down to South Carolina because we had a house there that was getting shut down. We
okay.
packed this U-Haul on our own with all the furniture from this house at USC and drove this U-Haul all the way from University of South Carolina up to the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, over the hills of West Virginia, up and down. And it was just, you know, again, in that moment, it was, you know, it was the last thing we wanted to be doing, but you know, there was a job to be done. We had to do it. And
sure.
looking back on that experience, you know, we bought the church on the courthouse steps in foreclosure. And again, we just saw it from nothing all the way to a flourishing fraternity house that ultimately it ended up net leasing to a sorority on campus. But
okay.
you know, it's just such a memorable experience
mm-hmm.
in my mind going through that. I mean, I've been a part of, you know, large development deals here in New York. You know, we were very active at the Kauffman Organization buying, you know, loft office buildings in predominantly Midtown South. We did a bunch of ground lease transactions, which, you know, anybody that has done a ground lease transaction knows that, you know, you come out with a lot more gray hair, you know, than when you went in. So, you know, I'm wholly New York focused now, but I really look back fondly on, you know, some of those early days, or, you know, a situation where, you know, we really either outperformed for the client or, mm-hmm. or got something that, you know, was sort of above and beyond the client expectation at the end of the day.
For sure. And yeah. What I got from that, I mean, some of your favorite or your favorite transaction is doing whatever it took, right?
Yes.
To do that again, going and beyond above and beyond for the client. But also, I mean, I would have been praying the whole way from that drive and that U-Haul.
Yeah.
So it's kind of funny you were going into a church, but, you know, using that and going above and beyond and seeing that all the way through, that's awesome.
Yeah.
So pivoting into our topic for the day, covering the current landscape of office investment sales in Manhattan. The sigh is coming.
Yes,
we
yes.
are here. So as we head into the end of 2023, top of 2024, what is the current state of the office market?
So the office market in New York is incredibly challenged.
Mm-hmm.
It is a very binary market. Mm-hmm. In that there are basically buildings on one side of the spectrum that are performing exceedingly well. They're new construction, they're Class A, they're around transit hubs like Grand Central, Penn Station. You know, the rents in those buildings are higher now than they were pre-COVID. So the idea that, you know, COVID has disrupted the office is 100% correct.
Mm-hmm.
But for the right product in the right location, the fundamentals are better now than they were, sure. you know, in 2019.
Okay.
The challenge is that, you know, work from home is real.
Mm-hmm.
And what once was leading into COVID, the hottest asset class in New York, which was this Class B loft office, particularly in Midtown South, or, you know, Midtown South, I would kind of define it as sort of 42nd Street to 14th Street, right?
Okay.
It's not the Plaza District. It's not, you know, Fifth Avenue, Midtown East. It's sort of the stuff below that where, before, you know, there's a supply constrained market there because it's more residential in this neighborhood,
right.
in these neighborhoods. You know, that area is significantly challenged today because, you know, it's just a tenant's market.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of these buildings are sitting half empty. You know, families have owned these buildings for, you know, multiple generations. They saw the run up. They bought these buildings in the 50s or 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, again, leading into COVID, they were turning away offers from people like me when I was at Kaufman for, you know, 600
yep.
bucks a foot, 700 bucks a foot,
yep.
because we were just trying to, you know, gobble up as much as we can. Today, with, you know, for, you know, a myriad number of factors, interest rates, you know, COVID, you know, all these mm-hmm. different things, there's winners and there are losers in the office market. And so it creates a very challenged environment when you look to, you know, either sell or refinance one of these buildings today.
Sure. And, you know, I think you were kind of touching on it and we'll go into it a little bit more, but, you know, especially because during the pandemic, I mean, New York City was just hit extremely hard, faced a unique set of challenges from a fundamental perspective. What's different now versus other market cycles? So either pre or post COVID, increasing interest rates, inflation. Sure. Give us your ideas on that.
Yeah. So I've been doing this for about 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
So really, I would say the two sort of market cycles are the two large, I don't know if I'm going to call them black swan events or sort of externalities that have driven extreme change within the real estate market. Obviously, the recession.
Yep.
And now sort of. Well, I'll say COVID, but also like this inflationary and interest rate environment that we're in
yep.
now, sort of couple those together. During the initial, like during the recession, I was on the principal side. So,
okay.
you know, we were raising capital, we were buying buildings. So, you know, it's a little bit different now as an intermediary, as a broker. But what I've seen today that I think is a little bit, you know, New York City is arguably and has been forever one of the most efficient marketplaces for commercial real estate, you know, on the planet, arguably.
Mm-hmm.
You know, New York City is viewed as an incredibly safe haven for foreign capital, private capital, institutional capital. You know, folks know when they're putting money to work in New York, you know, I want to say it's not hard to lose money because, you know, people do. But, you know, it's a very safe haven for invested capital. Today, however, it's my belief that at least in the office sector, the commercial sector, mm-hmm. New York has become one of the least efficient marketplaces to transact. And the reason for that is because, and this is sort of gets to the question of, you know, what's different now than maybe before.
Sure.
If you bring an office building to market today, the typical stuff that I'm working on, the sort of 50 to 200,000 square feet in this middle market space, anywhere from, again, 20 million to 200 million, the investor appetite for that building. And so an investor is somebody that's going to acquire that building, implement some business plan where they, you know, renovate the building, lease up the building, and then either look to exit or sit back and collect that cash flow or that profit, mm-hmm. that buyer is gone. Mm-hmm. Like those buyers are not there. They're not making bids on these buildings. And the main reason is because the cost of capital has gone up so much, sure. whether it be for their equity syndication or for their debt, right? To go get a loan or a mortgage to buy these commercial buildings. If you brought an opportunity to buy a value-add loft office building to a lender today, mm-hmm. and you showed it to 100 different banks, it's not just that your rate is going to be anywhere from 7 to 12%. It's that of those 100 banks, you're only going to quote from maybe 10, mm-hmm. if you're lucky. So it's like, it's not just that the capital's become more expensive. It's just that sure. there no lender is looking to increase their exposure
right.
to, you know, office in Manhattan. And again, there's a difference between sort of the class A billion-dollar glass and steel towers, right? That's a little bit of a different marketplace. But again, in the world that I'm living in, the private capital world, the investors have essentially gone away. They're there, you know, they're putting in their sort of lower bids, but for them, you know, they're just not competitive in the marketplace. So what it's done is it's created an opportunity for foreign investors, for user buyers, for, you know, private, you know, families that have owned in the city for a long time and view this as an opportunity. Basically, anybody that can buy, you know, all cash or all equity, not tap the debt market,
right.
those are the ones that are driving the market today. And that, again, in my experience, again, I've only been doing this for 12 years, but I've not seen a departure of those, the true investors in the marketplace for as long as I've been doing this.
Absolutely. And you kind of touched on some of my next points and questions. So in terms of deal volume, what kind of deal volume are you seeing happening in the office sector? Obviously, everything has slowed down, but what is happening and where is most of the activity happening?
Sure. So again, our focus at B6 is middle market, right? So we mm-hmm. would say, you know, we sort of do anything 5 to 200 million. On the office side, for me, you know, it's sort of around, you know, the same market. I would say sort of 20 to 100 million is kind of where most of the deals that I'm working on today are. I mean, the truth of the matter is, I mean, there's very little transactions
yeah.
and there's a lot of pent up, you know, there are folks that it's kind of crazy. There are people that I was knocking down their door, you know, offering to buy their building for, you know, X dollar per square mm-hmm. foot, and they wouldn't return my calls. You know, it was mm-hmm. when I was on the principal side. What's amazing now is I'm getting calls from these same people saying, mm-hmm. hey, Alex, you know, I know that, you know, what is our, my building worth today? You know,
right.
we have to put, you know, $1 million into our, you know, to redo our facade. The building needs a new roof. We have to redo our lobby. We're giving anywhere from $50 to $100 or more in tenant improvement allowance
yep.
so that they can make a building that's competitive in today's
yep.
environment to lease. And in a lot of cases, they're just tired of it. But mm-hmm. the problem is, you know, they're sort of anchored to this number that they were, you know, being offered in a different cycle.
Yeah.
And now
mm-hmm.
it's, you know, when I have to tell these guys, you know, your building's worth $200 a foot, $300
mm-hmm.
a foot, you know, again, it's situation, location dependent, but you know, so that, you know, the volume has definitely fallen off. One sort of, I would say, bright spot is that, you know, there's really no discretionary seller in the market today. And what I mean by that is no one's saying, oh, this is a great market. Let's throw it on and see if we get our number, you know, because
yeah.
they recognize that it's a mm-hmm. challenge market. So the folks
sure.
that are on the market, for the most case, are the ones that have to sell.
Mm-hmm.
And unless they're literally being forced by the lender or otherwise,
right.
they're only selling if they get their number.
Okay.
And so I think a unique dynamic today is that, you know, generally offers would follow a bell curve, right? Where you have sort of, you know, your folks that are in, you know, the low balls, and then you have sort of the meat of the offers coming in at the high end of the range, at the middle of the bell curve. And then you hope to have a couple outliers at the end, create a competitive bidding process and sort of push someone to the finish line. What we're finding, or at least what I'm finding on the office side is, you know, it's like the meat of the curve, first of all, is much lower than it once was. And you're lucky to find that one outlier buyer.
Mm-hmm.
And so in a lot of cases, you know, you get a contract out or you're negotiating with one group. And if that one group doesn't come through, you know, it's kind of back to the drawing board. So these deals are taking much longer to get done. But again, if you look at the comps, like pricing it's definitely lower, but it's, you know, there's still office buildings selling at values that are mm-hmm. to the investor don't make sense. They'll say, well, how in the world is this group paying, you know, $450 a foot for that office building? Well, it's because they're a user. It's because they're paying all cash, and it's because it took us 6 months to find them, you
mm-hmm.
know, but that's, you know, that's kind of what's happening right now.
So you're alluding to that. So we were talking about the difference of investors now between previously. So tell us a little bit more about that. So what kind of investors are conducting these trades? What are their motivations?
Yeah, so again, I think that the three main buckets of folks that we're seeing today that are the most aggressive buying and or bidding on these office buildings are, number one is foreign capital. Mm-hmm. Number two are commercial users. And number three are, we'll call it sort of the private family, like long-term owners in New York, where again, their parents or grandparents bought these buildings for $50 a foot or right. $70 a foot. And, you know, they saw the value increase all the way up to, you know, whatever it was pre-COVID. And now they think, okay, we have cash, you know, we can deploy and we're going to hold it for 20 years,
right?
They're not underwriting to a certain yield. Their model doesn't have an IRR in it. Mm-hmm. You know, they look at the bricks and they say, you know, I've owned the building across the street or the block down and I believe in New York long term. So those are really the three buckets of folks that we're seeing, you know, most active on these projects.
Perfect. I appreciate that. And I think that's a really good overview for our listeners as well. Are there any exciting nuances happening in office subtypes? So such as an example, medical office space or co-working right now?
Well, co-working is kind of the dirty word now, because there's, you know, co-working did a lot for the office market. I think it was an incredible disruptor. You know, both the big names that we all know and some of the small names that, you know, folks haven't heard about, but just the, you know, the pendulum swing from, you know, the sort of older school, you know, everyone's got their own office and, you know, to incredibly high density sharing, you know, 3 square feet of office on benches. So the pendulum was due to have some swing back, but really, you know, the co-working companies sort of propped up the office market into COVID in a way that I think some people either didn't see at the time or didn't sort of recognize even coming out of it, because, you know, they were gobbling up space faster than anybody else could, because, you know, they were, you know, VC backed or private equity backed, and they just had cash to burn through. And it's just growth, 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 growth. Today, you know, I don't know. And you know, I have friends that, you know, run some of these companies or are involved in these companies. And I think some of these models are incredibly well positioned for the future. And I think we'll actually see that segment of the market expand, sort of the co-working or shared working concept, you know. But some of the folks that signed some of these deals before COVID are in big trouble now, because you know, these tenants committed to big rents. The landlord in some cases wrote big work letters and spent millions of dollars, and now the tenant is either gone or not paying or in litigation. And so, you know, buildings with co-working tenants are, you know, in some cases harder to sell or harder to refinance, because a lot of times they're sort of locked into these leases, but again, they're either not paying or they're paying half rent, and you know, it's hard for a new buyer, again, because the user wants the space, right? So they want to take it over, and an investor wants them to be paying the rent that they had, you know, before. So it's, you know, there's a lot of sort of challenges presented by, I would say, sort of the older way of doing the co-working model on these leases. Now it's, you know, it's management agreements, it's revenue shares. So the companies have, you know, gotten smarter, and I'm a big proponent of that segment of the business. But definitely presenting challenges for some folks today.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, one thing about New York City is it's extremely resilient, right? Yes. In a lot of different ways. So what distinguishes New York from other cities, and what potentially can markets learn from New York's recovery?
So I don't envy folks that are on the acquisition side and have to be very smart in multiple markets across the country or across the world. I think our model of being, you know, New York focused and very specific in geographies, I think allows us, it gives us a little bit of a leg up against our competition, when we can say, you know, we know, I can tell you the difference in rent between 27th Street and 28th Street between 5th and 6th Avenues, right? So we're very, very hyper focused. You know, the office sector is, I mean, it's going through a, you know, significant evolution right now. The thing about New York, again, you know, there aren't many cities in the United States anyway, where, you know, again, there's the draw of foreign investment, the draw of the institutional capital. You know, we see a lot of money, we saw a lot of money leaving New York, going to states like Florida or Texas, you know, trying to avoid some of the regulation. A lot more of the regulation deals on the multifamily side than it does on the commercial side. But I mean, New York is, I mean, it's the greatest city in the world, in my opinion, certainly in the country. You know, if you're a, you know, if you're a young college grad and you're, you know, and again, Maybe things have changed a little bit, but you know, people want to live and work in these markets where you know the top talent is going, and I think New York will continue to be that. We're already seeing it. I think New York bounces back. I think you know I have friends and contemporaries that moved to Florida or moved to Colorado during the pandemic. They're coming back, right? You know, I think while again, office will continue to evolve and it can continue to be disrupted. I think folks are coming back to New York, and I think it's going to look a lot different. You know, is it 6 months from now? Probably not. But I think if we look back on this time, this moment of 2022, whether it be 2024 or 2026 or even 2030, I think, you know, it'll be back to, you know, to what it was at some point.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're kind of already alluding to these future predictions and things like that. So as a broker, what makes you most excited about the office sector? So what are your future predictions on the evolution of the sector? More open spaces versus cubicles. We kind of talked about that co-working space, continuation of hybrid workspace. Give us a little bit of your thoughts on future predictions.
Sure. So I think number one, I'm a millennial, I guess. But you know, the office market today, like anybody that's building a new office building today, they're not building the office for my parents or your parents or the generations above us. And honestly, they're not even really building it for us anymore.
Sure.
They're building it for the generation below us.
Yep.
And I think that's a very good thing. Mm-hmm. I tell this story anecdotally. I have a cousin who recently graduated college, and I was asking her about her work experience. And I said, you know, well, are you in the office? How many days a week? And she loves the fact that she's in an office because her college experience was disrupted by COVID, right?
Sure.
So, you know, you didn't have that same sort of
camaraderie,
sort of human-to-human interaction in the classroom on a college campus. And so, like, the younger generation, they want to be around people. They don't want to be working in their three-bedroom in the East Village, you know, 9 to 5.
Right.
I will say, Fridays are gone. I don't think we're getting Fridays back because I asked, I said, so, you know, you want to be in the office like full time? She was absolutely. I said, Monday through Friday. She said, well, Monday through Thursday.
Yeah.
You know, so I do think we may have lost Friday forever.
Right.
But again, I think the younger generation of people, I think are enjoying a period now of like, yes, it's great. I can, you know, work from a different city or I can have a different situation. At the end of the day, I think people want to connect with other people.
Yep.
And I think we're trending in a direction now where the younger generation really wants to be with, you know, with other people. You know, they want to meet their significant other. They want to, you know, they want to see their boss in person. They want to, you know, strive for that promotion versus being on a, you know, on a Zoom somewhere else. So I'm very optimistic about the future of office.
Sure.
Because again, I think it's being led by, boomers want to stay home and, you know, work from their houses in Long Island or New Jersey or Westchester. That's fine. And I don't think that's a problem. Like,
right.
I don't think that's going to be an issue for the office market in New York or, you know, anywhere else. Cause I think we're looking past that at this point.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more. I think I was talking with someone the other day and they said, you know, if you want to know if a brand is going to succeed, ask your 16-year-old daughter or friend or something like that. So I loved hearing that story because I think that that is the future. So that gives us a really good positive outlook on everything. So in that same vein, how are you kind of advising some of your current clients? What are your primary considerations as you're advising them through the current economic times?
So I start every, I'll call it pitch or meeting with a client that unless you have to sell today, you should not sell. It is my belief that, again, I'm a huge proponent on New York City.
Sure.
I'm bullish on office in New York. Again, for sort of the reasons that I've talked about, I don't believe that values all of a sudden are going to double overnight or we're going to come to 2024 and we're going to have an election and rates are going to go down and all of a sudden these buildings are going to be worth significantly more. I don't think that's the case. But I do believe that, you know, there's a challenge marketplace today. If you have to get something done, we can get something done. But I'm advocating that, you know, if you can hold on, you should hold because I do believe that there's sort of a brighter future ahead. And then, of course, the client asks, well, you know, when is that? Well, you know, you know, I don't have the proverbial crystal ball everybody talks about.
Yep.
But I am optimistic about, you know, what I'm seeing in the marketplace now. And again, like, you know, deals are getting done. Like, you can get a deal done, but if you can... If you don't have debt, if you've owned the building for a long time, you may take, you know, there may be a cash shortfall. You may have to come out of your pocket. But again, I'm advocating that you sort of hold for now for sort of a greener opportunity, you know, in the future.
Absolutely. I mean, that's a really good point. If there is anything right now that you can kind of leave us with in terms of Class A office buildings affected by current macroeconomic factors, inflation, rising interest, higher insurance costs, give us kind of an overview if someone did need to sell or what those potential, you know, factors might look like in terms of that transaction or deal.
Yeah, so the reason why the market is so binary now, again, is because you have, it is such a tenant's market. Mm-hmm. And obviously we care about the tenants because the tenants drive the value of the underlying building, right? Mm-hmm. It depends on what rent they're paying and what it costs the landlord to put that tenant in the building. That drives ultimately what somebody can or would want to pay for that property.
Sure.
Again, fundamentally, you know, Class A new construction office buildings are performing better now than they ever have. And so, you know, that segment of the market is doing very well, while the sort of Class B and less, again, and again, these are buildings that are, you know, they were built sometime between 1900 and 1925. In a lot of cases, they're anywhere from 50 to 100 feet wide. They're mid-block. It's a 100-foot deep lot, and they're built anywhere from 85 to, you know, 99 feet deep on these lots, so they can be long, they can be dark. They're mid-block, so there's not a lot of windows on the sides.
Yep.
And the problem is you can't change that. Right. Sure. Like you can't, unless you buy an entire block and you demolish the buildings on the sides, right? You can't create windows where you're looking into the brick wall of your neighbor.
Right.
And so if you look at the new buildings that are being built, you know, they're glass facades, they're massive ceiling heights, huge windows, outdoor spaces, building amenities, gyms, cafes, you know, all these things that, you know, these buildings become destinations for their tenants. Mm-hmm. You know, just really quick story anecdotally, you know, we're selling a commercial townhouse in the East 50s over here. And we've had interest from some significant, you know, landlords that, you know, it could become an amenity for them. You know, they would transition this building into an amenity for their portfolio because, it, you know, it's something unique, right? It's a private club that could cater to those tenants, right? So it's all landlords are trying to find that it factor, that differentiation that would drive you to my building versus the neighbors.
Sure.
So again, in the Class A, it's the outdoor space, it's the high ceilings. Obviously, everything is energy efficient. Mm-hmm. It's close to transit hubs because now you're trying to attract the talent back, whether they live in, you know, the tri-state, you know, New Jersey, Westchester, Connecticut.
Yep.
You know, they got to take the train in. They don't want to take, you know, you don't want to take three different trains, right? You got to take a train and you want to walk to the building. And so again, you see these, you know, prolific Class A towers going up, and they're doing really, really well. You know, the Class B, you know, those are, you know, again, you can't get rid of columns, you can't really change ceiling height, and so you kind of have to make the best of what you have. That's why it becomes so location dependent. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very, very building specific, where you could have, again, this speaks to sort of the inefficiency of the market right now. You can look on a block and you can have two buildings side by side that, for the layperson, they're identical, right? Mm-hmm. They're 12 stories, they're 100 feet wide. One building's getting $70 in rent, and the other building can't give space away at 35.
Mm-hmm.
And you say to yourself, well, how is this possible? It's because, you know, landlord A has created a different product. They've renovated their lobby, they've redone the elevators, they've maybe put in a gym, or they put in a cafe, or they put in a unique retail tenant, or, you know, they're offering more services, they're pre-building the space. And so there's this real, you know, sort of binary nature of the winners and losers in this market right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And you use something, you're saying like destination,
right?
You know, and people really want that. They want all of, you know, the different amenities or the different cool, unique things. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, we were talking about that other story. People want to go into work kind of you know, interact with people, but also have a little bit of that destination and close to transits, of course, to get people back in. Appreciate that. Now, coming in to a couple of rapid fire questions here for you, Alex. So given your specialized background and expertise, I know our listeners are going to be excited to hear some of these questions that I'm going to ask.
Okay.
So first and foremost, if you were given $50 million today and had to invest it immediately, what would your go-to asset type and location be, and why?
So as an office guy, I feel like I have to say office, right? Class B office in Midtown South?
Yeah, sure.
I think there is significant opportunity in this slice of the market.
Yeah.
And again, I remain very, very bullish on a select basis for particular bricks in particular locations where I think you can buy at such an attractive basis today.
Right.
If you wrote me a check for $50 million, I wouldn't necessarily have to go get debt today. right? Mm-hmm. So I could buy an office building, you know, I wouldn't have to tap the debt market. I could sit on it. I can try and keep it full, just sort of in its current tenancy, and then sort of wait it out. But I would be in at such a low basis comparatively to where, you know, competitors or other folks bought these buildings in the last cycle. I will plug quickly multifamily only because I think, you know, they talk about the ability to participate in an inflationary environment, right?
Right.
And so office traditionally has the longest, you know, lease term of any, you know, real estate asset, maybe with the exception of like a net lease, you know, like a, if you buy like a Chipotle or a Chase Bank, you know, somewhere. But the office sector, you know, you're signing, you know, traditionally a 5, 10-year deal, 15-year deal. And then if you go to the opposite side of the spectrum, it's hotels, right? Hotels reset their rental amount every day. Right, it's like, you know, you can look for a hotel in the city today, and maybe it's $250. You know, tomorrow it could be $500 because it's very demand driven.
Right.
So, you know, on hotels, you sort of ride the wave up and down. But to, I guess, so to diversify from my Class B from my Class B office asset in Midtown South, I would look for a free market multifamily because, you know, multifamily is, you know, there's a lot of increased regulation, and so it's getting harder and harder to own multifamily property in New York. But again, you're signing year-long leases, and you can sort of participate in the upside or in that inflationary environment. The downside is your expenses are also going up, and the sort of political environment is trending in a situation where it's getting harder and harder to increase your rents. But, you know, small, clean, you know, 20 unit, 25 unit, 30 unit multifamily buildings, again, in good neighborhoods in Manhattan, I mean, that stuff is bulletproof. You know,
for
like
sure.
you invest that money today, you know, and that stuff, again, I would own it forever. You know, that's the kind of stuff. If I had that money to put to work today, I think you can buy some stuff and own it for a very long time.
Yep. Amazing answer. Thanks so much for that.
Sure.
Second question, and I promise it is not a trick question.
Okay.
What is your favorite tool or software that you use on the job?
Crexy, come on.
So I promise I didn't pay him to say
No, really though. I mean, I think, so Crexy is a phenomenal platform because it does some things that some of your competitors don't. And so like I'm in Crexy every day. My team's in Crexy every day. You know, love getting the updates. You know, this person viewed the OM, this person's, you know, wants more information. But just sort of the, you know, today, like the real estate business really is a data business, right?
Yeah.
And so having the data on who's looking at stuff, who the bidders are, I think it also provides us an opportunity to cast, you know, we believe our philosophy at B6 is that, you know, we want to cast the widest net possible.
Sure.
You know, we don't do off market or pocket listings or sort of, you know, quiet deals. We believe that by casting the widest net, you bring in the most eyes to an opportunity. More eyes equal more bids, equal more competitive bidding process, translates into a higher price for our client, which is the goal at the end of the day. And Crexy really allows us to do that. But also too, as a millennial, I'm definitely not as good as sort of on social media and stuff as I should be. So really, you know, it's just phone and text, you know, like that technology, you know, my phone doesn't leave, I took it out of my pocket for the interview, but, it doesn't leave my side. You know, I'm taking calls, you know, early in the morning, all the way through, you know, late at night. You know, we have, you know, we use, you know, B6 is very tech forward. And so we have our own, you know, CRM and it's integrated and we have apps and all these different things, but I think, you know, embracing technology is super important in today's world. One, to, you know, stay competitive. One, to stay relevant, you know, to be out there on social media, to, you know, show the world what you're doing, show your clients what you're doing. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, our business is based on relationships. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, you got to pick up the phone. You know, you got to actually make those calls to get these deals done.
You always be closing. Salesmen never sleep.
That's right.
Couldn't have said it better myself. And last but not least, what is the most common misconception about your job or industry that we're in?
Well, I would say, and I say this in jest, obviously, but I think there's a misconception out there that brokers are, I'll say, sort of deal junkies, and they move from deal to deal, and they, you know, maybe they'll buy a listing or they'll overpromise to a client, like, yeah, you know, it's worth this, and you know, try, you know, do these different things, and so at least for me personally, like I really try and bring again that sort of different approach, that principal side approach. And I think really successful brokers do the same thing. I think, you know, anybody that is doing business, especially now in such a challenged environment, I think they have really deep relationships with their clients. I think they're very specific expertise, whether it be in a geography or an asset type, because data today, you know, for, I don't know, you know, a couple $100 a month, you can have access to the same data that everybody, like everybody sure. has the same data today. Or you can, if right. you want to know who owns an office building, you know, you can find out in 5 minutes for the most part, right? Or any building. And so today it's really about those personal connections. Mm-hmm. It's about having those meetings. It's about making those phone calls. Mm-hmm. I think that's really the sort of differentiator and what it comes down to at the end of the day.
Absolutely. I mean, you said it best yourself. Everyone can have access to the data, but what's going to differentiate you? And, you know, you've sat in these people's shoes, right? And you can relate to them and be empathetic and, you know, put yourself in that situation and really advise the client on that side of things.
For sure.
That's awesome. You've given us a ton of advice today, but before we let you go, anything else that you want to say to our listeners? Any words of advice, tips, anything else that you want to share?
No, I think, again, I've, you know, my tenure is not super long in this business. I've spent half of this on the principal side and half mm-hmm. on the brokerage side. I get a lot of, you know, calls and outreach, whether it be, again, from my, you know, Northeastern community or otherwise, you know, people that are getting in the business. And, you know, sort of two pieces of advice that I give folks is, you know, one, you know, really learn your, you know, define your universe, you know, define who it is. Like if you want to be I was given a great piece of advice from a mentor of mine very, very early on. You know, I told him, I want to be, he's been in real estate his entire career. And I sort of moved to New York, you know, a young kid. I was like, yeah, I want to be in real estate. And he's like, yeah, okay. You know, what does that mean? I was like, no, I want to be in capital markets, institutional. I want to be an investment sales broker. He was like, oh,
now
okay. So you know what you're doing. So he gave me a task. He said, define that universe. And so I researched every single top investment sales. This is back in, you know, 2012 or 13. And I literally made a spreadsheet of every top team at every group. I knew what deals they were doing. I knew, you know, I read every article about them, and I really defined that universe, and I made it my goal to get in front of as many of those people as possible. And so similarly, when someone, you know, again, a younger, you know, someone in college says, hey, I want to get in real estate, I say, you know, define that universe, you know, read the trades, read the publications, you know, and try and, you know, work your way, get in front of as many of those people mm-hmm. as possible. Because I find today, you know, again, there's a lot of those, yeah, I want to be in real estate. Mm-hmm. Well, like spend some time and understand, you know, this is what the broker side is like. This is what the principal side is like. This is what it's like to work in office. This is what it's like to work for a large institutional team, or this is what it's like to work for a two-person shop where you're, you know, putting deals together. Right. And so I think understanding sort of the environment or universe that you want to work in, I think is paramount. And then the second thing, I think this comes later on, but I've, again, only through my own personal experience have I found that having some whether it be X factor or experience or expertise, I think is critically important. Mm-hmm. For me, it happens to be this value add, you know, office product in Manhattan, only because, you know, by virtue of the fact that I've been doing it for this long, and again, on both sides of the table. But I think, you know, people are looking for experts today.
Sure.
Because again, the market is, you know, is challenged. And so I think, you know, really understanding whether it be a specific asset class or a specific geography or, you know, a specific deal size, you know, maybe, you know, you want to own that 1 to 10 million, you know, whatever it is. But I think having that focus, I think one, it helps you as a broker when you're canvassing or pitching, you know, it gives you focus, right? It helps narrow the funnel a bit because the city's a very big place with a lot of different opportunities. But I think it really helps you set apart from your competition when you're sitting in that meeting or sitting in that pitch or even just the coffee with the person to say, you know, like, this is my passion. This is what I want to do. Mm-hmm. So I think really honing in on something, I think, is becoming more and more important as data becomes more and more ubiquitous, you know, with technology.
I love that. I don't know about you guys listening, but I took a ton away from everything that you've said today, but so much about those two points. You know, I love that you say define what that means to me, right? Some people say, I want to be in love or I want to be in a relationship, right? What does a relationship mean to you? That's different to everyone, let alone some people will say, I want to be rich, right? What does that mean? How are you going to get there? What are the steps that you're going to take?
Have a plan.
So, you know, have a plan. Absolutely. Okay, I want to be in real estate. What does that mean? What's the territory? Mm-hmm. And then, as you said before, the knowledge knowledge is out there. It's everywhere. So really be that market expert. If this is your territory, who are the biggest players in the space? Make sure that you're talking to all your mentors and everyone in the space to really see, do I want to go into this aspect or this aspect? And then drill down and narrow in and be the expert in that field or that, you know, asset type. So that was huge. Absolutely. Thank you so much, Alex, for joining us today.
It was a lot of fun.
This was wonderful. If our listeners want to get in touch, how can they reach you? Email, social media, what's
Sure. Email, you know, it's just, it's awoodleaf@b6realestate.com. On LinkedIn, obviously, as I mentioned, I'm, my team is just getting me into Instagram. So actually I do have a new handle. It's NYC Loft Office.
Awesome.
So that's my new Instagram. So we're populating that now. So you'll see more and more stuff going there, but yeah, that's where you can find me.
Perfect. Well, you just got a new Instagram follower from me.
Awesome. Awesome.
Well, thank you so much, Alex, again. Such a pleasure to sit down with you. I gained a lot from this, and I'm sure our listeners did too. Thanks everyone for tuning in. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure not to miss the next one. Visit go.crexy.com/podcast and sign up to get the very next episode delivered straight to your inbox. You can also subscribe to the Crexy Podcast on your favorite podcast app or check out our YouTube channel at www.youtube.com/crexy. For video recordings of each episode. Goodbye, stay well, and we'll see you next time.